The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Romany Arrowsmith from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Vogue magazine and Rookie magazine. And the theme for today is standing out. This first article is called Getting Over Embarrassment by Pixie Casey from Rookie magazine. When I was 8 years old, I picked the wrong backpack. While school shopping, my mother had pointed out several relatively well-made options. "This will last you through the year," she said, holding up a black nylon pack with neon green details. "I think maybe you should go with this one." I, however, had none of it, and insisted on a red plastic bag with a cartoon cat teaching class on the back. On the first day of school, I proudly swaggered into my second grade classroom with my brand new plastic bag slung over my shoulder, but 3 months later, I found myself staring at my bedroom ceiling, unable to sleep, and wiping tears from my eyes. Because my mother was right after all. My backpack of choice was kind of gross, it smelled like a shoe, and worst of all, my much cooler best friend Kate had chosen a nylon bag like the one my mother recommended, as did all the other cool girls in the second grade. This memory seems silly now, but it remains vividly planted in my mind because I think it's the first time I felt ashamed over something so trivial. How could I have chosen the plastic cat bag? What was I thinking? Little 8-year-old me couldn't handle the poor choice I'd made only 3 months earlier. It was the first of many times I'd beat myself up over something that ultimately is meaningless. So I picked an inferior backpack. So what? Who cares, right? I wish 8-year-old me could have seen it that way. But she cared a lot. Things didn't change much over time. I consistently agonized over perceived mistakes, be they sartorial, romantic, or social, especially social, for most of my young life. If a teacher reprimanded me for talking in class or goofing around, it took me weeks to get over it. If I said the wrong thing to a friend or blurted something out that sounded harsher than I wanted it to, I'd replay the moment for hours and hours, scolding myself for being so stupid. If, God forbid, I accidentally got food stuck in my teeth or tripped on my shoes or let a large growl escape from my stomach, it was almost impossible for me to forgive myself. I was not allowed, in my eyes, presumably nobody else's, to make mistakes, to look foolish, or, you know, to be a human being. Embarrassment is as natural as breathing. There are so many rules, both spoken and unspoken, in our weird little world that it's almost impossible to get through a day without having at least one blush-worthy moment. Part of that comes from being trained by television and films and books to note certain things as excruciatingly embarrassing. Toilet paper on a shoe, a zit on the tip of one's nose, falling asleep in study hall and drooling all over a desk. We're conditioned to not do these things, especially as girls, because they're rude and uncouth and just plain nasty. On a physical level, we're meant to have control over our bodies. When that control slips, it's like breaking a human code. You're not supposed to pee your pants, even if you're scared. You're not supposed to pass gas in the middle of sociology class, even though your body desperately needs a release. You're not supposed to say orgasm in biology when you clearly mean organism. But you know what? Sometimes you do. And when these things happen, a series of events may occur. Maybe some jerk will hold on to the moment and dangle it in front of you for as long as they can, either because they want your attention or because they're insecure about their own mistakes. Or maybe your body will react with hot flashes and flushed skin and the kind of nervous sweat that no deodorant can conquer. Or maybe, and this is the worst one for me, you'll pick up the sense that the people around you are embarrassed for you, and you'll want to crawl into your locker, shut the door, and live there forever. On a social level, we feel embarrassment because we feel empathy. Think of all the times you cover your eyes or cringe when a fictional character on the screen is about to do or say something mortifying, or how you react when you see a friend get yelled at, or when even someone perfectly nice but not your type asks you out, and you know you're going to hurt their feelings by rejecting them, even though you're just being honest and true to yourself. We feel this kind of embarrassment because we know this kind of embarrassment. Anyone with half a heart has been there in some way or another, and we can recognize how icky and painful it feels for others. But it's hard at times to show that kind of empathy to ourselves. Instead of allowing the creepy feelings to run their course and move on, some of us tend to dwell on our embarrassing moments to the point where things spin out of control. Suddenly, it's not just the wrong answer we gave in class that's embarrassing, it's our entire being. I screwed up in class becomes, I screw up everything, which becomes, I'm screwed up and will be forever. Suddenly, the flood of past embarrassments comes rushing in and your brain, doing its dirtiest work, starts digging up painful memories from the past and adding new, completely unfounded anxieties to the mix. Example. Remember when you got dumped in front of everyone? Brain says, it's because you're ultimately unlovable and deserve to be humiliated. Remember when you got a D on that English paper and your best friend saw it and gave you a look of horror? Brain says, it's because all of those A's you usually get are flukes, and everyone, just like your friend, is going to see what a total fraud you are. Remember when that mean girl called you out for wearing off-brand shoes? Brain says, it's because you'll never be good enough for anyone. Remember when you picked the plastic cat backpack instead of the much nicer nylon one? Brain says, it's because you have no common sense and will never make good decisions. Yikes, right? The anxious brain has a way of taking a solitary moment of discomfort and turning it into a runaway train en route to Self-Loathingville Station. I rode this train for a long, long time before I learned how to hit the brakes. The only way to get out of that kind of spin is to immediately forgive yourself. Start by taking a deep breath, show yourself some kindness, and accept that you have two choices: spinning miserably around the incident or moving on, leaving it behind and opening yourself up to the possibility of making better memories to fill that lovely brain of yours. When I was a teenager, I worked as a server in a mom-and-pop type restaurant. The first time I dropped a tray, plates crashing to the ground, food spilling everywhere, I wanted to quit and run right out the front door. But I liked and needed the job, and instead I took a moment to compose myself in the bathroom before returning to the floor. One of the older servers, bless her, took me aside and said, "Listen, it happens. It's no big deal." What a magical set of words. It's no big deal. She was right. Even the best servers drop trays. Plates break, food spills, orders get messed up. Someone inevitably yells at you for forgetting to refill their sodas every 3 minutes. But the shift ends, you collect your tips, and you go home. The world doesn't stop when you screw up. It's no big deal. After being given permission to forgive myself and move on, I started handling my mistakes, and there were several, in my own goofy way. Whenever I dropped something, I'd take a bow and yell, "Thank you, ladies and gentlemen," and everyone would start clapping. Not only did I give myself permission to laugh, I gave everyone else permission to laugh too. This has been my trick for years now. Own the awkward moment. Make it funny before it drags you down. It is incredibly freeing and gets easier with time and practice. Eventually, you come to realize that these things really aren't a big deal and that you are fully capable not only of handling them, but of controlling them in a healthy, positive way by refusing to allow your brain to bully you into feeling ashamed of completely human experiences. Life is incredibly imperfect, and so are we. Yes, it sucks when embarrassing things happen, and it's hard making mistakes, but holding on to these moments and punishing yourself over and over again for something that can't be undone or erased isn't going to do you any good. So you screwed up. Guess what? So is every single living thing and probably a few ghosts on this earth. It is part of being real, part of being alive. The only thing you can do is accept that crappy stuff happens to the best of us, and all we can do is keep moving forward. Some things will be healed by time, which provides perspective, but most things can be healed simply by embracing imperfection as it happens. And you know what? I wish I still had that backpack. When I think about it now, all I can see is how funny it was. I mean, a cartoon cat, teaching class. Little 8-year-old me didn't have terrible taste after all. Now 9-year-old me, who threw that bag away, is another story altogether. Okay, this next story is also from Rookie Magazine by Sadie Doyle, and it's called Surviving a Small Town. And this is about how to stand out when you feel like you're in a place that kind of stops you from standing out. When I say that I grew up in the most boring town in America, I mean it. There is exactly one thing that makes Westerville, Ohio unique, and that is that it has no unique qualities whatsoever. It was a small town. You always ran into at least two or three relatives at the grocery store, but not small enough to be quaint or charming. It was Midwestern, but not Midwestern enough for us all to have super cool accents like Frances McDormand in Fargo. It wasn't close to any big cities, but it wasn't in the country either. The country would have been much cooler than what I ended up with. Out there you could farm and get in touch with the rhythms of nature and what have you. Maybe you could get a pony. In Westerville, we had no ponies. We just had the most boring town in America, slapped onto the side of the most boring city in America, which is Columbus. All of the stores were chain stores. All of the restaurants were chain restaurants. The only all-ages punk shows were at the local megachurch. And those were just some dudes who had grown goatees and gotten tribal tattoos so that it sounded less boring when they told us to obey our parents. Westerville, basically, was hell. A slow, boring, Jean-Paul Sartre hell where you are just locked in the same room with the same people for eternity with nothing to do ever. Let's talk to Lou Reed about this, shall we? Lou is correct that there's only one good use for a small town, or at least for my small town. You do know that you want to get out. But I used to feel very self-conscious about where I came from. Whenever I spent time around people with cooler upbringings, people who had always lived in big cities or who had grown up in vegan hippie communes or just hipsters who had to live in the most fashionable neighborhoods at all times and who made a big point of only hanging out with the right sort of people, I felt like a big, boring, bland nobody. I wished I had an interesting life. I wished I'd been from anywhere but Westerville. But that was before I figured certain things out. Yes, it can feel really good to get out of your small town, but before you do that, you have to live there. And there are actually benefits to that experience. If and when you leave, you're going to find that you are strangely far more interesting than many people with interesting life stories. Because here is the first thing you learn to do living in the middle of nowhere. 1. Develop unique tastes. For a while, it's probably going to feel as if you're alone in the world. If everyone else is into the high school football team, and you are into Lou Reed or 20th century poetry, or, let's just say, feminist theory, well, odds are, given the small population size, that you're not going to find many other people who share your interests. And it is certainly going to be hard to find a way to act on them. This isn't an experience that's reserved for people who have weird taste or even vaguely unusual taste. As it turns out, the biggest bands also skip the smallest towns. Nobody is getting Kanye West to play the sticks. His album with Jay-Z is called Watch the Throne, not Watch the Delightful Service at Applebee's. If you have a small movie theater, one town I lived in briefly only showed two movies at a time, and they were both art movies. We took an hour-long drive to see Ocean's 11 at a mall. Then you probably miss a lot. It's easier to get clothes and books in a small town now, thanks to the internet. You don't have to rely on a single faraway mall or the tiny local bookstore. Yes, it's charming and independent in theory, but less so when you see that the only display table is reserved for Harry Potter, and has been since 1997. But it's still hard to meet new people who can tell you about what's happening in terms of clothes and books. In fact, it's hard to meet new people generally. If you ever feel like you're in a social rut in your small town, well, I hope you like that rut, because you have already met everybody, and everybody has already met you, and you are pretty much stuck with them. But as it turns out, a bit of isolation is a good thing. People who grew up with the option of joining whole subcultures dedicated to their tastes always have to deal with the question of whether they'd still have the same tastes if they didn't have those same subcultures. I'm not saying they're posers, they're not, you're not, I love you all, etc., but they are people who've grown up learning about this stuff from others, and have consequently learned not only what to like, but how to like it. You, on the other hand, are free. No one is going to tell you what to like or how to like it, or even where to find it. So you figure out how to rely on your own judgment. This is what's referred to as taste, for the record. You're developing yours by finding out what you like, thinking about why you like it, and standing by that, even when people disagree with you. 2. Get research skills. The youth of America have a unique and wonderful blessing compared with previous generations. That blessing is called Tumblr. When you want to find out about things, you've got a billion people talking about what they think is cool, and sometimes posting snippets of it online for your enjoyment. In my day, we had no Tumblr. What we had was called Factsheet 5, and it was a directory of every more or less prominent zine in America. I spent weekends poring through Fact Sheet 5 with a highlighter, marking zines that sounded interesting and figuring out how I could get my allowance to cover as many of them as possible. You guys, this was so much better than Tumblr. Granted, I'm old and cranky, but having to find cool stuff the hard way taught me so much. Aside from that whole making your own judgments things we covered earlier, it taught me things like every piece of art has a history and a context. If an artist that you enjoy mentions having liked something, even just in passing, track down whatever it is they mentioned. Learn the names of people who are in bands you like, and then look to see if any of those people have been in other bands. If you enjoy a nonfiction book, read its bibliography. Track down those related books and related bands until you have a whole world of stuff to enjoy, not just isolated pieces. And get a library card. Seriously. This is the dorkiest advice I will ever give you, but get a dang library card. You'd be shocked at how much easier it makes things. My library had an AV section, stocked by someone who was really into 80s and early 90s indie-ish stuff. I found out what Sonic Youth and Pavement were by just checking out a few CDs with interesting covers every week. That's how I found out who David Lynch was, too. Oh, and if you're into clothes, let me tell you a secret. That crappy Salvation Army nearby, it's actually better than 88% of the vintage stores in large cities. You can get a dress for $10 that would cost at least $50 elsewhere, and there is far more interesting stuff to find, because it hasn't been picked over, because no one knows how great it is but you. Weirdly, it works this way socially, too. It's a cliche to say that small-town Midwesterners are nice. I don't think we are. We can be as sexist, racist, homophobic, or just plain mean as anyone else. But we are tactful. In smaller towns, people will treat you like a huge jerk, but they usually won't call you a huge jerk. And this is because we know that if we give in to our natural urges and call you a stupid butt munch, we are going to see you again. We're going to see you every time we go to the grocery store, and it's always going to be awkward. And even if we think we have gotten away from you, it will eventually turn out that we're dating your second cousin, so guess who's coming to our wedding because it's you. Now, I did not like being unable to call people jerks, so I moved to New York, where I can be a misanthropic judgy pants without reservation until the day I die, peacefully alone, surrounded by cats, as nature intended. But I will not deny that I made closer and more tolerant friendships in Ohio than I have almost anywhere else. Because the same thing applies. If your town has a very limited number of people, you can't just avoid people because they have unusual taste in music, or slightly different politics, or seem kind of weird. You have to learn what there is to like about their personal weirdness. And since there's nothing going on in town and you can't just stand next to each other at a concert, you actually have to talk to each other. Sure, on one hand, there's nothing cool going on in your town, no one cool to hang out with, and nothing to do. On the other hand, are you kidding me? There's decades and decades worth of cool stuff out there, publicly available and cheaper, even free. These are some of the most unique people you'll ever meet, and you have nothing but time in which to get to know each other. You just have to know how to look. And by the time you find other people who share your interest, they will be shocked by your keen eye and depth of knowledge. Number 3. Get creative. Oh, there are no cool bands in your town? Nobody is playing shows? You wish you were able to go somewhere and hear live music? Specifically cater to your own tastes whenever you want? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you over the sound of you not learning how to play guitar. Seriously, if you want new cool art in your life, you have 3 options. One, you can stand around with a bored look on your face and wait for some cool new art to fall out of the sky. 2, you can locate a supply, which is frequently hard if you live in a small town with few resources. Or 3, you can create the supply. You can take these amazing qualities of yours that we've been talking about, the taste that comes from having to cultivate and rely on your own judgment, the knowledge that comes from having nothing better to do than look hard for stuff to like, and you can create what is literally the newest, coolest piece of art you can personally imagine. I know. You don't know how to play guitar yet, or write short stories, or start a blog, or paint, or direct short films, or sew your own clothes, or take photos. It's fine to have a rough start. That's how you learn. Look at Mr. Lou Reed. He was the front man for the Velvet Underground, became a beloved proto-punk icon, and perfected that flat-talk singing, "I'm so bored and alienated that I can barely force myself through this stupid song I wrote" tone that the Strokes eventually ripped off, and that every hipster boy attempts to affect in conversation. He's a very accomplished guy, that Lou Reed. And here's how punk rock he was as a 16-year-old. Who's ready for a rousing saxophone solo? You are. So yes, might take you some time to learn your trade. You'll probably be bad at first. You'll create a few things you're not proud of. And no matter how good you are, the art you create as a teenager will be very different from the art you create as an adult. And that's fine. The only way a bad artist ever became a better artist was by making more art. Classes, feedback from your friends, editors, and all of that, they're nice. But you are never ever going to get better at something you don't actually do. And the good news is, if you enjoy creating art, living in a boring small town gives you lots of time to practice. It's not like there's anything else going on tonight, right? So let's take a look at you, and all of these awesome skills you picked up living in a terminally uncool small town. First of all, you learn to be an individual with individual tastes, and to analyze and defend your tastes. Seems like it might be useful in conversation. Then you learned how to dig up new cool stuff, even stuff that's relatively obscure. So it seems like you probably know a lot. And then finally, out of sheer desperation, you learn to practice an art form your own self, which is relatively rare. And given that you've done nothing but practice since forever, you're probably pretty darn good at it by now. Yes, small town girl, hang your head in shame, for lo, due to your not having grown up on a hippie commune and or in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, you have turned yourself into that least interesting of all things, a unique, articulate, knowledgeable person with great taste who could spot cool things before they're popular and is also a talented artist. Dang, who's gonna want to hang out with you now? Okay, guys, this next article is from Vogue magazine, and it's a profile of Aisling Franciosi, who stars in Jennifer Kent's recent film called The Nightingale, which is really excellent. I saw it last week. Highly recommend it. And she is such a unique person. I had to include it for this week's theme of standing out. Aisling Franciosi doesn't look like the type to keep a journal, an activity often associated with introverted adolescents. But sitting across from me at a downtown New York restaurant, sleek and composed in a white t-shirt and black pants, the 28-year-old Irish-Italian actor insists she is. Aisling keeps a work journal, a chronicle of her roles and auditions. If I'm feeling anxious, Franciosi tells me, it's good to look back and realize that this is just one of the troughs. She likes to keep the journal unemotional, but there are exceptions. The day Britain woke up to the news that Brexit had passed, she got a call offering her the lead in Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale, the director's follow-up to the highly acclaimed Babadook. She granted that news an entire exuberant page. In The Nightingale, out this month, Franciosi plays Claire, a 21-year-old Irish convict indentured to a British lieutenant in Tasmania in the 1820s. Rendering this brutal period of the country's history means rendering the countless victims of the colonial project, and the film does this relentlessly. You should feel something if you see it, Franciosi says. The Nightingale is a movie about cyclical trauma, and Claire is the wheel that rolls through it all. Franciosi's virtuosic performance hitting every emotional note, tenderness, terror, resolve, resentment, and rage. When Franciosi auditioned for the part in 2016, her biggest credits included a rebellious teenager obsessed with a serial killer, played by Jamie Dornan in the TV series The Fall, and a 2-minute bit as Jon Snow's dying mother in Game of Thrones. In the audition tape she sent Kent, Franciosi sang an Irish song, the very song, incidentally, that Kent had slated for a climactic moment in her film. As soon as I saw her, Kent tells me, I got that feeling I get when I know that I'm looking at the one. Without a celebrity lead, however, securing funding for the film took time. We could have chosen a more famous actor, Kent says, but I wanted to choose the right actor. Now that the film is finished, everyone is saying, who is this person? Where did she come from? The answer is complicated. Franciosi's dad is a heart surgeon in Milan, and her mom is a retired teacher in Dublin, where Franciosi was born. She spent the first 4 years of her life in Milan and then moved back to Dublin with her mom and older brothers when her parents separated. In the same way that Americans send their kids to Saturday soccer practice, the Irish enroll their wee ones in drama classes. After her first class, at the age of 6, I went to my mom and said, I'm going to be an actor, Franciosi tells me. She said, yeah, sure, but I'm pretty good at sticking with things. For a scene in The Nightingale, for instance, she swam in a frigid river until she fainted. At Trinity College Dublin, Franciosi strategically majored in French and Spanish. I love communication and miscommunication and well-structured sentences, she tells me. I'm not snobby, but I love getting it right. But more importantly, as someone already fluent in three languages, Italian, English, and Irish, she knew it wouldn't be hard for her to pick up a couple more. Meanwhile, she was moonlighting at the Cork Opera House and Dublin's Gate Theatre, and in March 2012, she was cast in The Fall. Her grades were good, but halfway through her final year, the school gave her an ultimatum: school or acting. It was an easy choice, even if she was within striking distance of a diploma. She's been told she's welcome to return. The plan is that, if I don't need to, I won't, she says, chuckling. In October, she moved to Tribeca and began acting in a limited series for HBO. I know this much is true. At home, she and her Calabrian boyfriend speak and cook Italian together. They recently bought a pasta maker. You can freeze ravioli. But it's been a weird year work-wise, she says, because she's mindful of what she does next. I would like to be considered an actor, first and foremost, rather than a starlet or a celebrity. That has meant turning down lucrative projects that didn't resonate with her. It's a gut decision, she says. In the meantime, she's busy exploring New York, often by foot, on either an epic walk or a run, an exercise lover, she forced herself to stick with running, her least favorite sport, until ultimately she began to love it. Shortly after leaving the cafe, she spots McNally Jackson Books. Oh, that looks cute, she says, pulling out her phone and, ever the curious chronicler, adding it to the robust list of places she'd like to visit. All right, folks, I have about a minute left, so I'm going to read a poem by teenager Bella Bob from Canvas Literary Journal. It's called Light Year. I wrote this poem 13 years ago, hand-speckled pink-brown in the sun-baked soil, mouth a collapsed stain of red number 5, puckered lips and popsicle breath in the softened belly of every up-tossed word. Time, that girl there said, time like mountains, time in the tick-tock, time under your nails, time until it's gone. Sometimes when the sun hits just right in the pink kind of way, world double zoomed in on the corners like honey on a fisheye lens, I'll sit there and pucker up on the sour sweet strawberry, holding summers like that, fingers deep in her sticky ripped denim pockets and eyes squinting against her long tossed hair. Old words, soft and sugary and soaked all the way through in a stale syrup, nostalgic brine. The words are weak and fit under my tongue with the spine of something unborn. I'll hold them, dense, up to the light, hold them in attempt to shield my eyes. And with that, we've officially run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Romani Arrowsmith, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138.